We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Anthony Herron, Score football analyst.
Matt Nagy, there were some adjustments that he made to the system to try and bring balance to the offense, but it wasn't balanced to the way the quarterback was tasked with doing it. I don't believe they felt like Mitch was worthy of them adjusting the system to suit him. It delayed this entire process.
Former NFL defensive lineman and Iowa Hawkeye.
Khalil Mack, he's fast, he's ferocious. When Mack is coming from the backside, then he's a guy who can make a game-changing, game-altering sort of tackle, where if an Anthony Herron is chasing from the backside, all right, you may get tripped up on your ankles, but you're not necessarily as worried about some sort of a strip or takeaway happening.
Co-host of the Score post-game show with Olin Krutz.
I think Matt Nagy knows he needs to win some damn games.
Big Ant Herron with Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi on 670 The Score.
It is our pre-championship weekend Friday here on The Score on Bernstein and Rahimi. Big Anthony Herron joins us now. He's on Twitter at Big Ant Herron. He is on the Alpamonte Nissan hotline, Alpamonte Nissan on North Avenue in Melrose Park, or at apnissan.com. Check him out on the Twitch stream as well. Anthony, how are you?
Daniel, doing well. Layla, as always, pleasure to talk to you both. Looking forward to some big games taking place to try and make it to, since I guess we're at the part of the year now where a lot of the commercials and the advertisement will have to refer to it as the big game as opposed to calling it the Super Bowl, then I'm ready for these teams to be able to ply their trade to go down that road.
The big game. Yeah, I always laugh at that too. Every single time.
Right.
Which one are you most looking forward to?
I mean, both are obviously more than intriguing. I think the AFC matchup, because there's uncertainty about where Mahomes will be at health-wise. You know, I mean, we're accustomed to the greatness of Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady. We've seen it so much over the years. Well, there's certainly plenty of meat on that bone. But I think in the AFC, we have seen Patrick Mahomes. He has ascended here early in his career, and he's won a league MVP and a Super Bowl championship and all those things. And Josh Allen is in the process of ascending and trying to get to sort of the next plateau of consistency in the NFL that he's kind of been approaching for a couple of years here. So the AFC matchup honestly intrigues me, I suppose, a bit more just from that standpoint, because you've got the storyline of the two younger QBs trying to get to where the guys in the NFC have already been for an extended period of time. I mean, there's, you know, for as long as Josh Allen and Pat Mahomes can even remember. I mean, you know, they're barely walking at the point where Tom Brady was on his way to NFL stardom. So, you know, I think that the AFC matchup, because Mahomes, there's still uncertainty there, and Josh Allen trying to do what he can do on the Bills side of things and everything that comes with Bills Mafia, I think that one is a little more intriguing because it'll tell the story of what will come of the league over the next decade, basically.
I really hadn't thought about it that way, but Josh Allen to me is fun to watch because it seems like where someone like Aaron Rodgers, his heart rate just never seems to rise. Mm-hmm. Josh Allen seems to be playing like his hair's on fire sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had comped his release to Marino when I saw the play to Stephon Diggs. It really looked like Marino to Duper to me. It was a very similar looking classic play. But he gets a little farvy. It's too in his so when he gets going a little bit and starts pump faking and he's holding the ball in weird angles. So he's he's on the seat of his pants sometimes trying to figure it out. But I'm there for all of it as a fan because he makes it fun.
Yeah, he does. And I think that for the way that both guys go about the position, where both, you know, Mahomes can obviously go off script, Allen can certainly go off script. Mahomes, he has always seemed very comfortable in that mode, and he seems to have both, you know, within the confines of the play, the ability to execute it, but then also a comfort with going beyond the X's and O's and doing things off script in a very similar fashion to Aaron Rodgers. For Josh Allen, I think that I would almost comp him, you know, I think the quickness, the sort of quick violence of the delivery, I think, yeah, similar to Favre and Marino, but then you go to kind of the overall physical stature and how his mobility is so consistently a part of his game. I would say maybe a bigger Elway might be where I would go with that too, where you've got the huge arm, you've got a big body that can be mobile and operates on the move really well, and that's a part of how the offense is schemed to make sure that's taken advantage of also. And you would think, you know, at some point, you know, as his career proceeds, that he'll need to, as he's already doing, get more and more comfortable operating from within the pocket, just like John Elway did. And you wonder if the franchise, if the fan base, you know, for what Buffalo had become for a couple of decades, and now the potential for what could be there right now with a young quarterback and with a squad that's sort of been building and putting pieces in place for the potential for sustainability, then, you know, if Josh Allen turns the Bills into a consistent winner, then, you know, it's kind of like Elway with Denver, where, you know, okay, you wonder, all right, what historical context can that be? And because of what that franchise is, like, there's a few Denver Broncos fans in other spots around the country, but they don't necessarily have that national sort of footprint like a Cowboys or a Steelers or even a Bears, you know, sort of thing. Like, there's almost a niche to the Broncos. There's a niche, in a way, to the Bills, despite their success in years past. And that's what occurs to me, both the stature, the mobility, and just the way sort of the lens those franchises operate in NFL lore, where I think, you know, maybe Josh Allen and Buffalo, if they become a thing for a while here, then I think there could be sort of a parallel between what Elway did with Denver.
I go back to the Week 5 game that got pushed back and pushed back and pushed back against the Titans. And we thought we were going to see the Bills team that I think we're seeing now.
Yeah.
And you remember the Titans just steamrolled him. And Derrick Henry had the ridiculous stiff arm, even though it was a play that got called back. It kind of encapsulated that game a bit for everybody. And I was like, man, I thought Buffalo was going to be better than this. Like, I thought Buffalo was going to come to ball. And then I thought Tennessee, thusly, because of performances like that, was going to be a little more competitive in the playoffs. But that just goes to show, I think, Ant, we don't give enough credit sometimes to the teams who really start to get in their stride, find that sort of progression later in the season to be where they are right now. You see it in the NFC game, too.
Right, and that's where, you know, we tend to kind of presume, and especially because of just the way the NFL is set up, where you get one game per week, and so every week is just the build-up in coverage towards the next game and the micro-analysis of every snap that took place in the prior game. And I think we don't necessarily give enough credence to the notion that teams will evolve throughout the season. Personnel will perhaps improve throughout the season. Schemes will adjust throughout the season, both from the opponents and from the coaching staffs within those particular ball clubs. And because we get the ability to break down the game to the nth degree before another game gets played in football, then I think we almost lose sight of the notion that teams can and often will look very different from one week to the next, certainly one month to the next, as you sort of work your way throughout a particular football season. And from Buffalo's perspective, I think offensively, you know, they do find themselves in a mode sometimes where, and especially by comparison to earlier in the year, they find themselves in a mode at times where they count so much on Josh Allen to win it with his arm and to abandon the run game. And that's, you know, they've just sort of come to the thought that, yeah, that's where they operate best right now. I do think we saw it in the second half of their game last week, and we may see them have to adjust as they get through this game against Kansas City, where if they're thinking they're going to go shoot out against the Chiefs, if they're thinking that, you know, they're just going to rely on Josh Allen to kind of outduel Pat Mahomes, presuming health there, then that doesn't strike me as the best formula, as the most likely winning formula there, not just because of the Allen versus Mahomes portion of it, but the overall personnel, the overall scheme and the execution of it. I do think that, you know, we don't necessarily need to see the Bills kind of take the air out of the football or anything, but I think some level of balance to how they operate offensively needs to be pursued and perhaps even achieved, just to make sure that it's not a game that's going to end up with, like, you know, 14 possessions for each squad. That doesn't strike me as where Buffalo should be looking to operate, because when it comes down to it, the more opportunities you give Pat Mahomes and Kansas City's offense, they are likely to catch you at some point, even if they start slow. We saw this repeatedly last postseason where Buffalo, once they roll, they have steamrolled this year, kind of like the Ravens of last year. But when it's nip and tuck, that's frankly where Kansas City has been better, and they find a way to get you at some point.
You know, Anthony, I noticed something. We talked last week with Robert Mays about this, and it's something that I've been trying to observe, that I've been more aware of, because usually one of our sort of thought exercises before the NFL Final Four is to say, what do we learn from their success? These teams got this far. What can we then deduce if they're here? Here's what other teams have to do to get there. I mean, we learn these lessons, and sometimes coaches learn wrong lessons. And this is where NFL trends start, where a coach will say, well, you know what? I've got to have two giant defensive tackles that each weigh 350 pounds. Or they say, I got to try this new zone blitz thing, or I've got to do a 3-4, or we've got to use. But you know what's happened? Football, the homogenization of winning football, is now cross-pollinated so much through college and the pros at every level, we don't hear that much. Other than saying, you know, I got to have a kick-ass defense and I got to have a quarterback that knows how to read what's in front of him. We don't really do that much anymore, because it's all out there. Every coach kind of knows what you have to have. If you look at these four teams, you can't come away with some of those larger things. Well, I want to do this like this or that like that, because everybody's running the same damn plays.
Well, and a lot of it is playing to the strengths of your personnel, right? And I think that, you know, one of the things I've marveled about throughout Tom Brady's career is that he's been able to, aside from just becoming mobile, which he never has been, but aside from that, within the confines of being a predominantly pocket passer, there's so many different versions of what his offense was in New England, what it's kind of back to becoming now in Tampa Bay. So he's had versatility in scheme, in what he's been able to do to attack defenses over the years, whether it was, you know, the more, you know, condensed version of a passing offense early in his New England career and play action based, and then sort of, you know, evolving into what became, you know, the record-setting New England offenses when he had Randy Moss in the deep game, and then it became the tight end based offense with, you know, a lot of 12 personnel and hitting, you know, Gronk and Hernandez and taking advantage of those formations, and then it became slot receiver based and having that be such a huge portion of it. Now he's back to Tampa, where, you know what, at you know, 75 years old, he still has the shot play ability that we weren't seeing them exercising in New England the last couple of seasons. But still, one thing that Tampa evolved as the season went on, and I thought Bruce Arians, Byron Leftwich did an excellent job of this, is seeing that especially against certain opponents, they needed to get the ball out of Tom Brady's hands more quickly. So they'll still find moments for shot plays, but especially with the way Antonio Brown gets utilized within their offense, they will find quick and rhythmic passes to get the ball to Brady. They'll throw it to running backs who, frankly, neither of them, whether Ronald Jones or Leonard Fournette, are accomplished pass receivers, but they'll just keep throwing the ball whether they drop it or not. This just has to be a part of our offense, so you guys better catch the ball because Tom's going to throw it to you. And they've kind of figured that element out of it as well. So it's a really good combination that Tampa Bay has going right now. So I think for all other three offenses, it's kind of, here's exactly what we have QB-wise, personnel-wise. You know, we'll throttle back. Matt LaFleur has throttled back Aaron Rodgers and what's asked of him. You think about what could have been in Green Bay with Aaron Rodgers if he was running this system as opposed to just saying, hey, Aaron, just beat him. You know, just do whatever you got to do. Hold the football. Throw it 80 times if you have to in a game and just win. If he'd had this around him, maybe Aaron Rodgers from a victory, from a championship standpoint, could be in a different stratosphere than he's in right now. And he'll get that opportunity because it looked like he's got a few more years of his peak to come as well with Matt LaFleur. But I think for Tom Brady, the versatility he's shown in his ability as an individual quarterback to adjust systematically, schematically with personnel that he's had throughout the New England career and now to the personnel available in Tampa Bay is really a thing to marvel at.
Yeah, that's where I sit with this NFC Championship game. Tampa Bay, clearly, I think, has more weapons, right? Like, they've got all the weapons. And that's what we thought they were going to be at the beginning of the season. We thought that this receiving core was going to be exactly what we're seeing it be. And then when it comes to Green Bay, it's like, well, you've got Devontae Adams and Aaron Rodgers, and that's pretty much all you need. Mix in Aaron Jones, you're good.
Right.
I don't know. It's interesting because I don't know who's going to come out. Like, if it's going to be the team with more weapons or the team with just really effective weapons.
Yeah.
And efficiency or just riches.
And I think that because of the kismet that seems to be there with Matt LaFleur and Aaron Rodgers right now, that goes towards why their offense is so effective. They're really good up front on the offensive line, but they're made better. Their performance overall is better because of the way that Matt LaFleur orchestrates the offense. I've discussed this with you both a lot over the years, just by comparison here in Chicago, where the system hasn't been called towards the personnel. And thus, not only does the quarterback struggle, but the offensive line struggles in part because of that also, where, you know, pass rushers get more opportunities to defeat blockers when the quarterback holds the ball longer, when the quarterback throws it from the pocket as opposed to on the move more frequently, and all those things that in Green Bay, where they've got the guy who's as mobile as you could really plausibly want a quarterback to be, has as much acumen to be able to diagnose things as you could ever hope for, and oh, by the way, has one of the most talented arms in NFL history to hit every blade of grass on the field and throw the ball with nuance, different arm slots, fit it over defenders, drive it through tight windows with velocity. Aaron Rodgers can do everything you could ask a quarterback to do, and now they have balance. Now they have called movement of the pocket. Now they have a commitment to the run game. And so we're seeing a Green Bay offense that where Aaron Rodgers may be mildly diminished physically as far as his arm, certainly his mobility mildly diminished at this point. But because of the way LaFleur orchestrates things, and you have this balance between the two of them where it's a little side adjustment. It's a finger wag here. It's a wink there to Devontae Adams. And LaFleur has found that balance where he didn't necessarily like quarterbacks to audible much, but he and A-Rod got together over the offseason and put this thing together in a fashion that I believe overall you're seeing an offense that's so difficult to stop because of the fact that Aaron Rodgers can do so much, but Matt LaFleur has said you don't need to do nearly as much as you were before because we'll make sure that the few studs we do have will get the ball in a variety of ways. And it makes the defender's job that much more difficult because the talents physically can take over from QB, but also just the play caller consistently puts his personnel in a position where they're not shouldering much of the load that frequently.
There's a lot more going on in the NFL besides just these two games. A lot of transactions and hirings and firings, and the Bears, who are shedding more coaches than they are adding. So we'll talk about all of that with Anthony Herron when we come back on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
You got to figure out, as a head coach and a general manager, what do you want to be the main influence of your defense? Do you want them to be protection up front and then responsible in the defensive backfield? Or do you want to be aggressive from the line of scrimmage through the linebackers and then put your defensive backs more in a playmaking position? Because when you look at the quarterbacks in the division, you look at the new coach in Dan Campbell, you look what you have in Minnesota because they're going to be changing now that Gary Kubiak is gone, and then what you have in Green Bay, obviously, you have the GOAT of our division. So I do think it's really important when you investigate what the defensive coordinators bring in with them, what type of style do you want to play?
It's Bernstein and Rahimi, middays 9 a.m. to noon on Chicago's Sports Radio 670 The Score and the radio.com app.
You heard Tom Thayer. That was last night, Bears All Access, talking about how Matt Nagy should approach the hiring of a defensive coordinator. He's got another opening, too, if in fact there is an opening at passing game coordinator, whatever Dave Ragone did. But this is all informing this decision and these interviews that, for some reason, I have no idea why, included Mike Singletary in this. Do we know, Anthony Herron, how far along the Bears actually are and how they're going to decide these kind of questions that they're asking of their coordinator of what philosophy they're going to have.
Well, I think that, you know, for Matt Nagy specifically, and I suppose Ryan Pace, the quote unquote football guys who have been tasked with kind of figuring this out, they know the personnel that's here. There will be some cap related decisions that have to be made about who continues on. You know, if Akeem Hicks ends up being a cap casualty or something like that, we can certainly hope not, but you know, that potential is there and how that may affect the type of system they're willing to run. I do think that, you know, it's noteworthy that Jay Rogers, while being considered for taking over as the defensive coordinator of the Bears, was willing to move on and go to the Chargers, even in the midst of the potential for a promotion here in Chicago, the franchise who he's become a prominently known NFL assistant, a highly respected NFL assistant here with the Bears, and with at least right now what's under agreement, the majority of the personnel who he coached from last season would still be expected back next year. And he was willing to go out to the Chargers. And, you know, as far as I can tell, the Chargers didn't say he's like assistant head coach / defensive coordinator. I don't know exactly what his role is out there, but he just said, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to go meet up with Brandon Staley. He's a young, talented guy. We apparently got along before. And so he's going out to do that. So whether that's indicative of just wanting a fresh start, if it's indicative of whatever he may think is on the way here, if he thinks his guys are maybe getting a little longer in the tooth and perhaps the productivity could continue to dip going into next season. But the fact that he wasn't willing to just sort of wait unless he got some sort of definitive word that he's not going to be the guy, that part is surprising to me. And I think it indicates something. I suppose we don't know exactly what yet until we see a few more results about who gets hired and certainly what the players look like next season.
I said earlier yesterday that I am now worried about the status of Sean Desai on the staff. Could he join everybody with the Chargers? I think we should be a little bit concerned about that. And he's gotten some glowing recommendations this week from guys like Sam Acho, players talking about his acumen and his level of being that next Staley type of upstart coach.
And I think that for a guy like Desai, who, as some of these head coaching hires that we're seeing now, aren't widely known publicly or through the media sphere around the league, then it would take a level of foresight that, frankly, we just haven't seen from the Bears so much, whether it's player evaluation or assistant coaching evaluations. We haven't necessarily seen the foresight that they've shown to say, you know what, we're going to grab this individual who we feel like is a rising star and say, here's this prominent role that you perhaps have never held before. And I don't think that's necessarily all a bad thing if you're not, you know, like Ryan Pace has done in the draft where he loves his gems, his diamonds in the rough. But overall, it's not the worst thing in the world, especially for a first-time head coach in Matt Nagy to surround himself with experience. But now that he's been on the gig for a few years, I think, you know, he should be the one who's viewing himself as experienced and as hardened on the job, who's maybe willing to recognize talent on a staff and thrust someone into a role that maybe they haven't actually held before because you are confident, you believe that they can handle it and that they would do it at a high level. And that needs to be the point that Pace and Nagy are at right now. Like, I get it early on where maybe, and perhaps it should have been Ryan Pace bigfooting Matt Nagy to say, you know what, I feel really strongly about Brandon Staley, and I think yeah, he should be your defensive coordinator as opposed to going the Chuck Pagano route. Who knows what the defense would look like if that were the case, but they haven't done that. And I would imagine part of that is because Matt Nagy was inexperienced as a head coach. And I've said it multiple times, I liked the willingness to surround himself with experience on the staff, because not everyone does that. A lot of folks like to keep people around them who they don't think could do the job better than them. Matt Nagy didn't necessarily take that approach. He wanted his staff to be experienced, to be veteran. And I think that was probably the proper approach. But for right now, and figuring out who takes over this Bears defense, if they feel as strongly about Desai as Sam Acho does, and I heard the clip that you guys played when you played it back for the discussion that Acho had with Zach Zabin. I mean, if they think he's that kind of star, then yeah, give him the opportunity. I certainly don't know enough about him. I do know he's highly regarded within those walls, but I don't know enough about how he would call the defense to think it's the right move. But I think the Bears, need to be willing to make that move if they see that in him.
We had a study in contrasts yesterday when we were having fun at the expense of Dan Campbell, now the Lions head coach, when he just made a complete ass of himself at that press conference, just sort of doing that whole outdated tough guy bit. Mm-hmm. And it's yet another job that Eric Bieniemy does not have, despite being the coordinator of one of the league's most innovative and exciting offenses. And while this guy was spouting his "I'm going to eat lightning and crap thunder" and all of that stuff, here's Eric Bieniemy speaking very candidly about what it's like being passed up for so many head coaching jobs.
Here's the thing: it's always good to be mentioned and having an opportunity to pursue your dreams. And obviously, yes, I do want to be a head coach. But when it's all said and done with, my job is to make sure everything that we're doing right now is not to take away from the goals that we're trying to accomplish. The only thing that matters today, we got better. Okay, today we had an opportunity to make sure we can take care of situational football as far as short yardage, goal line, and our third down situations. So now it's time for us to go back in and chop wood, watch this tape, and get ready for the next day. We want to make sure that we're getting our guys ready to make sure they can take care of business on Sunday. My own personal business, when all that's time to take care of itself, that will take care of itself.
And this is a guy that doesn't interview well. I'm sorry. It's getting to the point of ridiculousness where you have this guy, the tight ends coach of the Saints, who comes in looking like a cartoon character. And all this guy is doing is coaching football and doing what he's supposed to do. And now they're dragging out, well, he doesn't call plays. Well, you know what? The guys in this system who haven't called plays, whether it's Frank Reich or Doug Peterson, they didn't call plays either. And they were a nominal offensive coordinator, and they got head coaching jobs. But now this guy can't get one, and you're saying the reason is because he's not calling plays. You know, I'm done with it. I'm done with it, because this is after everything, after all that gets said and all that gets done, and the Fritz Pollard Alliance and all of that. This is one of the worst hiring cycles that minority coaching candidates have had in I don't know how long, and it sucks.
And you know, there's the crowd there who's gonna say that, you know what, well, not every job can go to a black guy. Well, not every job should go to a black guy. And I don't hear anyone saying that. The point is, there's an absurdity to the results within the process as it sits right now. How does it get fixed? Frankly, I don't know how much more the NFL can legitimately do to fix it, aside from continuing to just shove noteworthy minority candidates in the face of let's just call it 32 NFL owners, to keep it simple, and say, here's possibilities for you. And I've talked about this in a variety of different ways over the years. Like, you both know, for folks who don't know, like I was an executive with the Arena Football League, a senior executive for six seasons in doing that. And it's not, this is, you know, years ago, it's going back a decade basically at this point. That's not an opportunity that I would have gotten to do that, just to open kind of a different door in my life in a league that I cared about, that I played in after I was out of the NFL, and the communications end of things that I was in charge of for them. That opportunity came for me as a black guy in his early 30s to be the number two executive in a professional sports league with 20 teams all around the country and national television deals, negotiating with this company and that. I got that opportunity because a Chicagoan, a guy named Jerry Kurz, who had just taken over as the commissioner of that league, saw something in me I think I was like 31 at the time. And he said, you know what? I think you can handle this. You haven't done all this stuff before, but I think you can do this gig. And he gave me that opportunity to manage that. I interviewed with him, interviewed with a couple of owners. They said, yeah, let's do it. And frankly, I did it pretty well for a guy who learned a lot on the job. And when we're talking about whether it's the Rooney Rule in the NFL or what would be thought of as affirmative action in general, the ability to interview and then come out of that interview, and if folks say, well, just the best person will or should get the job, it's just not that simple, because it all ends up being subjective. The results of that interview, the way the person you're sitting across from evaluates you, comes a lot from the perception or the proclivities of that person handling the interview. So whether or not they're comfortable with you or more comfortable with someone else, because that person has a similar background to them, or frankly just looks more like them or talks more like them, there's a comfort that can be inherent in that, and you need to be able to, as I did. And when I was hiring different people for the Arena Football League, you have to be able to look past that and try to determine whether or not this individual can do the job, regardless of whether or not their background or their appearance or their manner of speaking or the types of stories you may share are similar to yours or not. And that's where the owners around the National Football League continue to shirk the what I would call the responsibility for pursuing diversity in a league that is predominantly African-American but has so few African-Americans in leadership positions, regardless of how much league staff have tried to push the envelope for owners to pursue more of it.
And if we're going to go at this whole interview situation, you would figure a press conference is a piece of an interview.
Right.
And I would argue that Dan Campbell, while he was very detailed in how he would basically kill a guy, Eric Bieniemy's coaching you up in the interview. Mm. Eric Bieniemy is coaching us up when he's talking in that press conference right now. He's doing what you want to hear a coach say to football players. When he's like, we got to go out and chop wood. I'm like, dude, I got to chop wood on this show. I got to bring it to Anthony Heron right now. Like, out of respect to Eric Bieniemy. I don't get it. It's that whole you have to work twice as hard thing. And we just keep seeing it.
And it's over and over again, and it's so repetitive, and it's not going anywhere anytime soon, but it's part of why it's important to continue to call out the absurdity of the results. The process itself, like, no one can go up to, let's just call it the 32 owners to keep it simple. No one can go to the 32 owners and say, you have to hire Coach X. You can make suggestions. You can place them in front of them. You can give them the opportunities for the interviews. But frankly, can you really watch Dan Campbell on camera or in front of a microphone and think that individual would interview anywhere nearly as effectively as Eric Bieniemy? That there's no way you can plausibly make that intellectual argument. But when it comes down to it, and it's the new general manager in Detroit is a black guy. So, I mean, it's not like it's all A plus B equals C. There's a process from the top down, whether it is the Detroit Lions or a variety of other teams in their hiring practices, that for whatever reason, the comfort that comes from ownership around the National Football League has not led to, you know, the frequency of prominent black assistant coaches getting the opportunities as frequently as the numbers would just indicate, not just someone's heart or you know, someone's, you know, personal, you know, sort of preferences, but that the numbers would indicate should be the case at the executive level and at the level of becoming a head coach. And the whole interview thing or play caller thing, you laid it out there, Dan. I mean, that doesn't make sense because you're seeing a whole lot of other folks who obviously couldn't have interviewed that well by comparison to what you throw back to Tony Dungy or put it right now to Eric Bieniemy. There's no way you're sitting across from those guys saying that, you know what, I don't know if he's really interviewing that well. And then you're sitting across from Dan Campbell, who his players love him. It's not necessarily anything against Dan Campbell. It's against the results of the process because Dan Campbell and the Dan Campbells of the National Football League are getting opportunities that other people who are at least as, and in a lot of cases far more qualified for, have resumes far deeper than what he's been able to put out there in the league. He's getting that gig as prominently. A lot of times it is a white coach getting that gig for the first time, like I was just talking about the Bears reaching down for that assistant who could be a rising star. It tends to be the white guy who they're reaching to go and find this rising star more so than it is the minority coach.
Outstanding stuff, Anthony Heron. We will talk once again next week, and we'll have a Super Bowl to preview.
All right. Enjoy your foosball this weekend. Look forward to it.
That is Anthony Heron with us. We were going to do the Midday Midway, but I don't think we should because Hank Aaron passed away at the age of 86. And I think we need to talk about him. And in just over a calendar year, I believe we're now at, I think, 9 Hall of Famers who we've lost in recent days. It really has been, I mean, and even some, you know, other very prominent baseball players who didn't rise to the level of the Hall of Fame. But it's Hank Aaron is an immensely important American, let alone just a baseball player. So we'll talk about that next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
One ball and no strikes. Aaron waiting, the outfield deep and straight away. Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone. What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol.
Vin Scully on the call of a huge day in the history of sports, and nobody can frame it better than that guy could. Hank Aaron died peacefully in his sleep last night. He was 86 years old. Bernstein and Rahimi, Sports Radio 670, The Score. And I went back because I wanted to make sure I had the list of names of the number of former baseball players that we lost in just the last calendar year. And there's an article here from December 26th, and it lists Tom Seaver, Lou Brock, Bob Gibson, Al Kaline, Whitey Ford, and Joe Morgan. The day after this was published, Phil Niekro died. And that made it seven in a calendar year, and that equaled the number of Hall of Famers who passed away. It's the number in 1972. And then just last week, Don Sutton died, another Hall of Famer. And then last night, Hank Aaron. And you start to feel your mortality at some of these times, because these were now we're talking about the guys whose baseball cards I had, guys who I remember seeing play, going to games and actually watching them. And it's tough, but Hank Aaron is, as far as overall meaning goes, is probably carries much more social, societal, historical significance. And I like what Howard Bryant of ESPN said. He called him a bittersweet symbol of both American racial intolerance and triumph. And I think that's very well said.
Ah, absolutely. I always think about what fellow athletes say about Hank Aaron, and the tweets are coming in, the reactions are coming in as well. Frank Thomas, you could tell he of course idolized Aaron. He said he was a standard of greatness, the definition of class. Coming from Frank Thomas, that's high praise, as you can imagine. Also a fellow man from Alabama as well. And what about Muhammad Ali when he said that he was the one man who he idolized more than himself? That gave me goosebumps.
And I think people don't remember that. And when we think of sluggers, we tend to somehow see them as Paul Bunyan sized people, because so many of them are. Hank Aaron was 6 feet tall and 180 pounds, and was originally a middle infielder. You know, the hammer and Hank, just not a big dude. And I think in that respect, he always embodied an aspect of baseball that has made baseball connective, in that baseball was the sport of people who look like people, where it's not everybody's 7 feet tall, and you don't have to weigh 275 pounds or 300 pounds. That there was an everyman aspect. And I also think some of that underpinned the animosity toward Barry Bonds. And now is probably not the time or place to have, you know, the debate about what's real and what's not and what records are recognized and all of that, because there's that gets tiresome and misses the point. But I do think that that supersized version, that cartoonish version of Barry Bonds, it took away from the humanity of the fact that man at 180 pounds could hit the way he hit and have the slugger profile the way he did, just because of some immensely quick hands.
I'm going to tweet the link, because WSB out of Atlanta, the TV station, eulogized him in a really, really poignant article. But they go through his history, and one of the comments they said was his family was so poor they could not afford baseball equipment, so he began honing his baseball skill by hitting bottle caps with sticks. You want to talk about somebody who was inspired, and necessity drove him and did not stop him. You don't put that into words very easily. And we all got to see his performance. That was one of my favorite parts about going to all the different ballparks. You get to see the memorabilia, and you get to see the homages that are paid. And I made it a point the first time I went to Milwaukee to make sure I saw the plaque where his home run landed, because he's a titan of the game.
His career spanned from 1954 to 1976. Hank Aaron still holds the MLB records for RBIs with 2,297, total bases, 6,856, and extra base hits, 1,477. He's third all-time in hits with 3,771, third in games played, 3,298. and he's fourth in runs scored with 2,174. And I will say this is, you know, there's always like these little personal connections that the very first baseball bat that I owned had a Hank Aaron signature on it, a Louisville Slugger with a Hank Aaron signature. That was, you know, when, unlike kids today who grow up with, you know, 13 or 14 different bats and the axe handles and the various Eastons of various drops for various leagues, you had your one bat. That's what you had. And it's probably still in my parents' garage in that big cardboard box sitting there. But that was a Hank Aaron bat, and you always sort of you feel that, you never forget that.
No, it's just everything about him symbolized baseball to me. You know, growing up when you do, like, just everything about him symbolized baseball. But when you hear that some of the things that he said and what he had to put up with.
He couldn't play in high school, right? Like, that initially in school, only whites were allowed to play. And for him to even get started was unlikely. For him to find his way was unlikely. And he batted cross-handed. And it was attributed, the strength of his wrists was attributed in large part to when someone finally showed him how to put his hands properly on the bat. He had developed such a snap in his swing from literally batting right-handed with his left hand on top of his right for so long.
Just the stats that you could name about him. U.S. Postal Service said that Hank Aaron received nearly 1 million pieces of mail, which was more than any non-politician at the time in history. And how he addressed everything just so really classily. You know, just brilliantly, and I could not have said the same. But the quote about him saying he had to sleep at the ballpark sometimes, and he said, for some reason, I always felt like I was safe in this ballpark. Those were some of my greatest moments and my safest moments. I cannot imagine. Cannot. And to have the level of success he had despite all of it, superhuman.
I believe he also recently, I mean, just last week, I want to say, he made sure that he made a photo op of getting the COVID vaccine because he understood the symbolic value and of what it would mean for people who might, based on some ugly American history, might be reticent to get that. So even down to his very last days, he was doing things and making sure that he was photographed and making sure that the photograph was shared because he wanted to be a positive example, even to his last week of existence for doing the right thing for people.
Not only that, but he got it at Morehouse School of Medicine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That I did not know.
Yeah. He made sure to get it at Morehouse School of Medicine. I will tweet out the WSB link because I think they just did a really brilliant job in trying to at least encapsulate who he was. And there's going to be so many great pieces that come out, but you don't want them to because that means he's gone.
We're going to have a conversation with Stacey Dales coming up next. She is covering the NFC Championship game for NFL Network, and we look forward to getting her perspective on the frozen tundra coming up next on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.